Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking about the Supreme Court. And our guest for this program is Ron Rotunda. He's professor of law at George Mason University. He was, for many years, professor of law here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign and was a guest on this program. We're pleased to be able to talk with him again after some time. He has authored a number of books that are used in law schools around the country. He's the co-author of the most widely used course book on legal ethics and also is the author of a leading course book on constitutional law. He has written many articles that have appeared in law reviews and journals and newspapers. He's also worked with a number of other countries as they have developed constitutions. In 1993, he was the constitutional law advisor to the Supreme National Council of Cambodia and assisted that country in writing its first democratic constitution. He's also consulted with various new democracies in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union on their proposed constitutions. As well, he's been involved in a number of committees of the American Bar Association that deal with issues of professional conduct. And this morning, we thought we could talk a little about the court, how it has changed over recent years, and welcome questions and comments from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that would be good for anyone who for whom would be a long-distance call. If you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or in fact anywhere around the country, if you're listening on the internet, you may use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Rotunda, hello.
Hi, David. Good to be back.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. Before talking about the court, there's something else that I wanted to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about, something that I know that you have spoken about and argued for, and that is a proposal, and it is now before the Congress, that would create an Office of Inspector General for the courts. There are similar kinds of offices for other branches of government, but there has not been one for the judiciary. And you have argued, and I think some other people have argued, that this would be a good thing. Perhaps you could just talk a little bit about what exactly this person, this inspector general, would do. What would be his or her responsibilities?
Well, basically, audit the courts and report to Congress if there's a need for legislation to deal with problems of discipline, as well as reporting about discipline of federal judges. The federal judiciary is a remarkably great organization, but every once in a while, there's a bad apple or two. And right now, these things are all, the discipline is all done in secret. There's been a couple of controversies with claims that some cases just were not handled properly. And in fact, a recent report by Justice Breyer said that the error rate was, for some of these high-profile cases, is just too high. That is, error rate of judges not being disciplined when they should be. So the inspector general can deal with this. There is a concern that this would compromise the integrity of the courts. However, the bill that the House committee passed on a bipartisan basis would have the Chief Justice appoint the inspector general, and he or she would serve at the pleasure of the Chief Justice. So it's all still going to be done within the Article III courts. So I think the claim that this would interfere with judicial independence I just don't think is valid.
So we're talking about something here that the inspector general would be responsible for overseeing the federal system, federal courts?
Yeah, just federal courts. Yeah. For example, there's a case in this is the second case that the Ninth Circuit had trouble with in California. They're now investigating the federal judge who awarded more than $4.8 million in fees and judgments without disclosing his personal, political, and business ties to the people who benefited from this. It's a judge in Las Vegas. There was an earlier case also from the Ninth Circuit with a judge in California who ended up assigning the probation officer for this 40-ish old woman, assigning him to himself and giving her some very favorable rulings in a divorce with her husband, even though the divorce was not supposed to be in federal court. This was subject to discipline, and the Judicial Discipline Committee said we were powerless to deal with it because the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit had not had done something procedurally wrong. And the dissenters, it was a 3-2 decision, the dissenters said this was an outrageous interpretation of the statute. In any event, the majority said, oh, Congress should change the statute and we should inform Congress. But, of course, no one ever did, except that it got in the newspapers. So the inspector general would then be the official arm to actually enforce Congress. They don't have to rely on an AP reporter.
Hmm. How is this handled at the level of lower courts?
Well, there are all kinds of complaints about judges, typically from disgruntled litigants. Right now, you give it to the chief judge of the court or the clerk of the court. He'll send it to the chief judge, and there's a committee within the court to deal with this. I think that's fine. You know, I mean, a lot of these charges are simply false. People who are just upset, and just like many people in prison claim they're all innocent, but they all can't be innocent. But having said that, the discipline process is done in a very secretive fashion right now, and the inspector general would be a check on that and make some of it more open, so that the sunlight is the best disinfectant. If we had an inspector general, I'm confident he or she would find very few problems, but we'd all feel better knowing that this more independent force will tell us there aren't any problems. Right now, it's judges who are friends of each other who tell us there are no problems. In an article I recently wrote about this, I quoted a federal judge who wrote me and said this is what a Kiss My Sister Act, and that we need someone with a little more independence who's not the personal friends of the judges being investigated.
Well, where does this stand now, particularly that we now have a new Congress? This was before the last Congress. Do you think it's likely that this will go forward?
Well, if I knew the future, I'd be rich. It was passed in the House committee with very few dissents. It was the great majority of both Republicans and Democrats voted for it. But now we have a new House. And the bill may just die. I just don't know what will happen. The main person who is pushing it is no longer chairman of the committee. And so if the new person isn't interested, nothing may happen with it.
Does it matter what the members of the Supreme Court think about this? It ultimately, is it not the case that the Supreme Court is the ultimate, is supposed to be the ultimate oversight for all the courts?
No, actually, I mean, the Chief Justice is head of the Judicial Conference. They set up rules and so on. But the discipline system doesn't go to the Supreme Court for judges. Hmm. It goes to ultimately a national court of retired judges who decide these issues. That's the one that decided 4-3 in this case involving Judge Emmanuel Real in California. And it was made public. Often these things aren't. And the publicity of that case was basically the spurt, what led to the proposal for an inspector general. But it doesn't go to the U.S. Supreme Court. It goes to this group of retired judges. They're thought to be very objective. Mm-hmm. The problem is that most of this is done in secret. And if there is a criticism, as there was in this case, we don't even know about it. But for the fact that some judges wrote a scathing dissent, and then the newspapers picked it up.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ron Rotunda. He's professor of law at George Mason University. And here we'll be proceeding to talk about some other subjects. So we want to talk a bit about the Supreme Court. But certainly, if people have questions on this matter that we've talked about here or anything else, you can call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, and we'll bring them into the conversation. Someone listening in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Professor Rotunda, this is somewhat tangential to what you're saying, but my concern in terms of the integrity of the federal judiciary, it deals with the fact that there doesn't seem to be a mechanism in place for decisions to be made independently of the Supreme Court justices, the Chief Justice or the Associate Justices, when it appears there may be a conflict of interest in them hearing a case. It seems like they make the determination themselves as to whether they can sit, as opposed to recusing themselves from a case. And a recent instance, I think, was when Justice Scalia went duck hunting with the vice president and later decided that he could sit in a major case involving the energy committee's revealing information to the public. I find that disquieting when there doesn't seem to be any regulatory oversight body to decide whether or not Supreme Court justices are acting unethically in this regard. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's been the rule from the beginning that each justice on the Supreme Court decides individually whether or not he'll sit, and there's no appeal from that. If a federal judge refuses to recuse himself, that can be an issue on appeal. And there have been cases where the U.S. Supreme Court has reversed a lower court decision because one of the judges did not recuse himself. But the Supreme Court has not put itself under... There's no court higher than the Supreme Court. In the, I'm not sure what the solution to that would be. You could have, if there's a motion to recuse, you could have it go to the entire Supreme Court to decide rather than the individual justice. But we don't have a court higher than the Supreme Court. We can have, we do have federal statutes that mandate recusal in certain situations, though sometimes they're not followed. I mean, there's a federal statute that says that if you own even one share of stock, you or your spouse, you must disqualify yourself in every case involving that company. And a few years ago, there was another AP reporter, you know, thank goodness for the newspapers and the press media in general, found out that Justice Ruth Ginsburg sat in about 20 cases where her husband owned stock. Well, this became public. She apologized. Her husband said it won't happen again. And as far as we know, it doesn't. But it seems like what shame and publicity is the main purpose. The statute was fairly clear, and I don't know why she didn't recuse herself. I'm sure it was all in good faith, but it was troubling.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. There has been quite a bit of reporting lately. I have seen stories in, I think, a number of the major newspapers having to do with the number of cases that the court agrees to hear and the fact that some people think that there has been a very significant decline in the number of cases. And in fact, here I'm reading from a story that was in the Washington Post recently. In William Rehnquist's first term as Chief Justice in 1986, the court heard 175 cases. Last year, that number was just 82. And so far this year, it looks like the number might be in the high 60s, 67, something like that. Perhaps there might be more. And there's been a lot of speculation about why it is there has been this significant decline in the number of cases. Why do you think it is that the workload of the court seems to have declined significantly?
Well, it has declined dramatically. It's not only about 50% of what it was from when Rehnquist started on the court, but if you go about 20 years before that, it was twice as much as when Rehnquist started. I mean, it's really gone down 75% reduced load. I mean, some people are cynical. They say as the number of books that the Supreme Court justices write goes up, the number of opinions go down. It is one of the few jobs in the world where you have the summers off, just like grade school kids. You know, you get the 3 months off during the summer. And sadly, there's a lot of cases out there where there's a conflict among the circuits. When the circuits disagree, that's a good reason why the Supreme Court should take the case, but it's not required to, and they always don't. And there have been some important cases where the courts just refuse to take it. I really don't know why. I suppose if we all could choose our workload, maybe on the whole we choose less rather than more. Now, over the years, Congress has given the Supreme Court, by statute, for the most part, complete discretion over its workload. It used to be required to take certain cases. Now there's hardly any cases it's required to take. And that's allowed them to do this. Now, we'd like them to think about these cases. It's better to get things done right than to get them done quickly. But I think that's just a problem, and there's no hint that the Supreme Court is going to be increasing its caseload. Well, I think there's good arguments why it should.
Mm-hmm. Something that confused us, and I'm sure that you can explain this, having read these stories about the decline in the number of cases that the court agrees to hear, if you go to the website of the Supreme Court, here there's one page that is headlined, The Justice's Caseload. And here it says, the court's caseload has increased steadily to a current total of more than 7,000 cases on the docket per term.
Yeah, but they don't decide those cases.
Well, I guess that's what I thought that meant. So what we're talking about is the difference between the requests to hear a case and the number that they actually say, yes, we will hear that case.
Right, yeah, 7,000 okay. people say, please hear my case. Right, and the okay. Supreme Court says, we'll hear 70 of them or 80 of them.
Okay, so there has been an increasing number of people asking for their cases to be heard, but a decreasing number of cases that the court says, all right, yes, we will hear that case.
Right, and it's not... It doesn't take a lot of time to decide not to hear the case. Once you hear the case, then you have to read the briefs. You go to the oral argument. You go into discussion, and then someone has to write the opinion, and there may be concurrences or dissents. So taking the case is a decision to take on a fair amount of work. But of those 7,000 cases, the great majority will be summarily dismissed, and the court will simply not decide it.
Hmm. Who is it that, I'm sure it's not the justices, I suppose it's the clerks and the staff of the justices that actually look at these cases and make the decision whether or not they will be taken?
Well, in the old days, you go back to the 1940s and so on, the judges looked at this. And then over time, they gave more and more discretion to their law clerks. Justice Stevens is the only justice who decides himself, or let he and his law clerks decide whether they're going to vote to take a case or not. It takes 4 votes out of the 9 to accept a case. The other justices have what they call a cert pool. That is, they'll give their law clerks these applications, and then the law clerks will make the initial decision. To some extent, it may be a final decision. The law clerks are usually recent graduates of law school. They've been out of law school 1 or 2 years. So it's giving a lot of authority to people who don't have a lot of experience. It reminds me of there's a discussion in Gulliver's Travels where Gulliver talks about how you can't get to see the high muckety-muck until some lower-level person allows you to see them. And we have some lower-level people appearing to make some significant decisions. The last justice that personally looked at every cert petition, best as we can figure out, is Justice Douglas.
Hmm. Let me ask you one other question having to do with this, the decline in the number of the cases that the justices actually decide to hear and the explanations that have been given. One of the explanations has been that over time we have an awful lot of judges now, appellate judges, who were appointed by Republicans, and we can should expect them to be conservative. So perhaps the reason that the justices on the Supreme Court are taking fewer cases is that they are more in tune with the judges that are making the decisions in the lower courts, and they're not likely to decide that there's something there that's been decided incorrectly, and so there will be if there are fewer cases there where there are decisions they would disagree with, then maybe naturally there would be fewer cases they would decide to hear.
Well, this is a nice theory. The statistics don't support that. First of all, 8 years of Clinton ended up appointing a huge percentage of the federal judiciary, and over time it's been roughly half and half. The other thing is that there's a lot of conflicts in the circuits. So it's not that we all agree, why bother to take the case. I mean, it is true, if they do take the case, statistically, they're more likely to reverse than affirm, 60-40, something like that, 55-45, it depends on the year. But they'll still take cases and then affirm the rule so the whole country knows what the rule is. But these conflicts in the circuits where the Ninth Circuit disagrees with the Fifth or the Seventh Circuit in Chicago disagrees with the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, they're still out there, and the court's not taking them. Plus, you also find a higher and higher percentage of statutes that state that federal judges invalidate either the federal or state statutes. You know, I don't know whether Congress is just making more unconstitutional things or not, but they're invalidating these things. So if you think, well, everybody is conservative and they're just affirming what Congress does, the statistics don't bear that out either.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ron Rotunda. He's professor of law at George Mason University, and where he teaches constitutional law and legal ethics. He was, for a number of years, professor of law here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And we're talking this morning a bit about the Supreme Court. And questions are certainly welcome. We have someone here ready and waiting. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes?
I'm on a cell phone, so I'll ask a quick question and listen off the air. I'm concerned about keeping high-quality federal judges, and particularly given the fact that the salaries compared to what people can get in corporate laws, Greek law firms, is maybe half or less. And I just wondered if Ron could talk about that problem in our system. Thanks.
All right.
Well, I mean, it is a problem. The justices, I think, get about 160,000. The lower court judges get a little bit less. That's a huge amount of money for the typical person. On the other hand, someone fresh out of law school can go to a major law firm and get as a starting salary about 120,000 or more, and that's someone who's about 25 years old. So this is a problem. Congress is often reluctant to raise the salaries of these people to be higher than their own salaries. So they've broken it's not a one-for-one correlation anymore, but it is a problem. A thought I've had, I mean, it is also a lot cheaper to live in the middle of Montana than it is in Manhattan. And we have a nationwide salary, so for some people, the salary is a lot better than it is for others. And a big problem for all these judges is when they get to be in their 50s and 60s, kids go into college. And so I think one thing that might be cheaper for the federal government, in addition to their salary, is to give them pay for the college tuition. The people that have kids will be able to have that worry taken off their mind. Plus, it'll be cheaper for Congress to do it that way than to raise a salary for everybody. Now, judges do retire at full pay. That is, the federal judges can't have their salary diminished, so when they retire at full pay, and they don't put a penny into their retirement system. It's all governed by you and me and the other taxpayers. So the salary is a little higher than you'd think, but you are right that this is a fairly low salary compared to, if we're really talking about the best of the legal profession, they can command much higher salaries. And what Chief Justice Roberts said about a week ago is that we're getting to the point where more and more of these people are being picked from government service, where for them is an increase in salary. And what we want are the best of the best, rather than the ones who think it's the best job they can get in terms of salary. So this is a problem. It's one that Congress can solve, either by raising salaries generally or possibly by giving them free tuition, which will take a big load off the minds of the judges and cost Congress a lot less than raising everybody's salary.
Something that I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about that has to do, comes under this heading of how the court has changed in the last couple of years with the change in the makeup of the court, with the death of Mr. Rehnquist and the retirement of Sandra Day O'Connor, and then the addition to the court of Roberts and Alito. Something that seems to be the case here, I think that the Chief Justice has something to do with this, is that it seems to be that now the members of the court are much more willing than they have been in the past to talk about themselves and about the court. And we see that they're doing interviews, which is quite unusual. They're making more speeches, perhaps, and that's not completely unusual. But there seems to be a deliberate kind of increasing the visibility of members of the court. Is that something, do you think, that assuming that you think that that's the case, is this a deliberate kind of change, and has that been brought about by the Chief Justice, Mr. Roberts?
Well, I mean, it happened before. He's only, you know, one robin doesn't make a spring, and so he's only been Chief Justice now for, what, a year. Hmm. So it's a little bit hard to extrapolate from the small sample. But I think it is. I mean, we've had judges in the past give interviews, but not too many. Justice Black gave one towards the end of his career on television. We do have judges giving interviews when they're promoting their books, and that's perhaps a financial incentive to do that. But you know, this is a public institution. The court, in fact, is the only public institution of the three branches of government that, if it does its job properly, everything is public. That is, everything that goes into the decision is public. These are the briefs. And everything that all the entire rationale for the decision is all supposed to be public. That's the opinions. Newspaper reporters find this frustrating because it's harder for them to get some kind of inside quote. But all the rationale is supposed to be in the public opinion. And so it's a public institution. Someday we'll have cameras in the federal courts, although Justice Souter said it would be over his dead body, but at some point we're going to have that. And it's a public institution. I mean, they're not supposed to be rock stars, but I think we'd feel more confidence if we knew more about them and what they're doing.
It seems that I think there are a lot of people who would agree with you, and yet at the same time, this seems to go against a very long tradition that while the activities of the court are public and open, that there seemed to be this real reluctance of the justices to be public figures, to be out there to talk about themselves, to talk about their work. Yes, I suppose theoretically anyone can go in and sit there and listen to the arguments as they're made, and yet at the same time, all of the really important work of the court really does happen behind closed doors, and it's the kind of thing that people just don't talk about.
Yes. There's a lot to be said for the judges they're not supposed to be rock stars. It's not supposed to try and be court publicity. Some of this may be just the press is covering it more. That is, a typical speech is they're invited to a law school or to ABA or other bar convention, and they talk to the lawyers, but the press is there. Shortly before I left Illinois, Justice Scalia, we invited him over. I was on the committee, and he gives a speech about judicial review and so on. It was in the really big auditorium on campus that seats, well, like 600 or 700 people, standing room only and so on. When I first got to Illinois and a justice would give a talk, it filled the law school auditorium, 140, but nowhere near filling 600 or 700 people. So people are more interested, and then the press is covering it a lot more. We'd have these situations where there'd be maybe just a no-print journalist or maybe just one. When I first started, now there's cameras and several print journalists. Now, the judges, I remember Justice Scalia told me once, he thought the judges should lie low in the grass. They're not supposed to be seeking publicity. He doesn't like his picture to be taken. He said he can go various places. People don't recognize him. He went to one hotel. He goes in with his wife and like 5 or 6 of his kids, and he signs in Antonin Scalia, and the fellow at the desk says, "Well, welcome, Mr. Scalia." And he said, "It's Scalia." And the man at the desk has said, "Oh, like the justice." Didn't recognize him at all. And there's a lot to be said for that.
Something that you were talking earlier just about the fact that you think that at some point, sooner or later, there will be cameras in federal courts, although
yes.
I'm sure that there are still a lot of judges and maybe members of the court who would oppose that. Something that they actually have done, this began with, I think, just before their last term. This goes back to last fall. Apparently, the court has decided at that time that they would make transcripts of oral arguments available on the day that they're argued, free on their website, which is something that they hadn't done before. Usually before, it took a couple of weeks until they were there. And also something that was new with this is that on the transcript, it says which justice asks what question, and apparently that is new. I am sure that all of the current justices would say, yeah, over our dead bodies, courts and cameras in the Supreme Court. But this does suggest that maybe there is some increasing willingness to have the proceedings of the court be generally available to people who are interested in trying to follow them.
Yes, and I think that's good. I mean, they say this is a public institution. We ought to know what's going on. In the old days, you can go to some of these courthouses in southern Illinois, and the courthouse would seat a few hundred people, 200 people maybe, 150 people, and they were built in the era where the whole county only had a few thousand. People would all come. We can't come to these things. And the oral argument is public in the sense that individuals can go there in person. It's public in the sense that there's oral transcripts, there's oral recordings of what's going on that's released in some cases much more promptly than before. And then, of course, there's the written transcripts. It's already public. And I think at some point we're going to have cameras in the courts. We do that for many trials already, typically in state court. There's a concern that judges will play to the camera. Well, I think the average voter, the average adult in a democracy can see through that and will look askance at people that seem to try to play to the camera. And after a while, we'll just get used to it, and then we'll see what these oral arguments are, and I think we'll have more confidence in the judicial system when we do.
These two changes, apparently, where this greater availability of the transcripts and the identification of the particular justice with says who asks what question, this does really seem to be deliberate attempts of making things a little bit more open by the Chief Justice. That it seems like that was his decision. Were there other things that you can say, other ways that you can point to, even though you said that obviously he hasn't been Chief Justice all that long, other things that you could point to, changes in the way that the court operates that you could say were directly the result of something that Mr. Roberts decided?
Well, we know that at the end of each oral argument, they have a conference of the nine justices, and that's very private. Not even the law clerks are there, just the nine. And if in terms of seniority, the youngest justice, brings the coffee and answers the doorbell. And those conferences have been getting longer. And we think, as we sort of look at these things and try to extrapolate, that may be one reason why so far there's been fewer dissents and more majority opinions. Not that the issues are simpler, but that the court has had more time to work out differences face-to-face rather than simply through written memos to each other. So we say it's, one robin doesn't make a spring, and we don't want to extrapolate from too little data, but the suggestion is that we know he's had longer conferences, and we think that might be why he has been able to get the people to agree on more things and fewer disagreements, and partly by writing narrower decisions that are just deciding the issue before it. See, the Chief Justice doesn't, I think he makes about $500 or $1,000 more. He makes a little more money, and he's called Chief, and he gets to sit in the center. But it's like herding cats. He doesn't really have a lot of power over these individuals. But he can do things like have a longer conference, meet more frequently, and nudge them in the right direction. And he seems to be doing that.
And after the justices hear the arguments, then they go and they sit and talk about these things. Do they argue with each other? Do they attempt to persuade each other to take a particular position? Or if there is one justice that seems to be leaning one way, other justices that disagree, do they argue with that person and see if they can get that person to change their mind?
Oh, sure. They've been doing that for a long time. They try to persuade each other. There have been we know a lot of things once people die and leave their letters or memoranda to historians. We know that once in a while an opinion will change from it'll actually change majority. That is, somebody will be writing a dissent and he gets enough people to change their mind so that the dissent becomes a majority. They communicate an awful lot by written memoranda. At least there's an awful lot of written memoranda out there. Now, they can walk down the hall and chat with each other And maybe they do that, but we'll have to wait until some law clerks leave and tell us things, breach their confidence and tell us what's going on. But they're always trying to cajole or persuade each other, mm-hmm. which is the only power they have over each other. We do have a lot of historical evidence that there is no log rolling like there is in Congress. That is, you will not find cases where the judge says, I'll vote for you in this case if you vote for me in the other case. Each case seems to be treated on its own. And we will find cases with strange makeups. In one of the detainee cases, the dissent was Scalia, considered one of the more conservative, joined by Stevens, considered one of the more liberal. And because I think Stevens found what Scalia said had to be persuasive on many other matters, they disagree with each other.
I think that there were a lot of people who expected that with the change in the court that we saw after a fairly long period of stability where the makeup of the court didn't change all that much, then there was a very significant change when Mr. Rehnquist died and then Sandra Day O'Connor decided that she would retire. And so we have this too. We have a new Chief Justice and a new Associate Justice, and that both of them were assumed to be conservative, and that perhaps the big change here was not so much the replacement of Mr. Rehnquist, but was the replacement of Sandra Day O'Connor. And I think that the expectation was that here now, with the addition of Roberts and Alito, that it would be a more conservative court, and certainly the decisions would reflect that. Well, it hasn't been all that long now we've had the two new justices, but has it been long enough to say, did the character of the court, has the character of the court changed significantly in that direction? Is it more conservative? Can you point to a particular example, some decision that shows that this is a very different court from the Rehnquist court?
No, not yet. If you look at the last 2 or 3 years of the Rehnquist court, a multiple guest question here. Who was the justice that agreed with Rehnquist the most? That was O'Connor. If Alito was a lot like O'Connor, he may not be much different than Rehnquist, because they agreed with each other the most. Now it may be in campaign finance. There's a campaign finance case coming up this term, and it's not going to change the world, but there. If Alito is, and that issue, Rehnquist and O'Connor disagreed. It was a 5-4 opinion. The issue before the court is really whether to expand or narrow the McConnell versus Federal Election Commission, the big case decided 2 years ago. And if Alito is more like Rehnquist and O'Connor, that would be a 5-4 going the other way, but it's not going to overturn the other decision, I think, but it may simply prevent it from being expanded. But say those two, their last 3 years, were agreed more with each other than with anybody else. The news often says that Scalia and Thomas are always agreeing. Actually, the two justices who agree with each other the most are Souter and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The general quick statements people throw out in the news headlines don't always comport with the statistics.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ron Rotunda. He's professor of law at George Mason University, was for a number of years professor of law here at University of Illinois. He teaches constitutional law and legal ethics. We're talking a bit about the Supreme Court this morning in this hour of Focus 580. And we have about 10 minutes left. Questions from people who are listening are certainly are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. In terms of cases that have already been argued, there certainly have been several that have gotten attention. One that has to do with public schools and their attempts to achieve racial balance, depending on how that's decided that could have serious consequences for public schools around the country.
Oh, yeah, that's a big
and,
one.
And that's a big one. There also, there was one that has to do with the procedure that some people call partial birth abortion and whether or not that that is constitutional. Those are two that by their nature got a lot of attention. And there were a few others. I think it's true that probably some of the cases the court hears are so technical and deal with such obscure legal points that nobody outside of the people like you probably pay very much attention to them. But cases like these, they do get a lot of attention. If you look at those that are already that have already been argued from last year, those two or anything else, do they stand out to you as particularly important, depending upon which way the court
decides?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the affirmative action case, and the court decided, 5-4 with O'Connor in the majority, that colleges could decide to basically take into account color to get the right balance. She said, I think, for the next 24 years or 21 years, something like that. And that was 5-4. Kennedy, considered one of the moderates or liberals on the court, who had dissented in that case. Now, if Alito, it depends what Alito and Roberts do. In the case that the Grutter case is the one that Bollinger case, the one that allowed the affirmative action, made a point that this was college and graduate school, that there's a limited number of seats and that colleges want to get diversity of viewpoints and so on. They've said in the past that K through 12 is different. Everybody goes someplace. The only question is where you go, and they've allowed assigning people by race when it's necessary to basically overturn prior segregation imposed by law. And so my guess would be in that case, unless they overrule the earlier opinions, they're not going to allow K through 12 to do what they're going to allow the universities to do. At least that's what the precedent suggests, but we'll have to wait and see. And that will be a good clue as to how Alito and Roberts come out. The partial birth abortion is anybody's guess. Kennedy has been a big supporter of abortion, except for partial birth abortion. In the prior birth abortion case, he basically compared it to infanticide. You know, it's whether the head or the legs come out first. And O'Connor said, well, you have to have an exception for the life or health of the mother. And it depends how broadly you read that. That if you're talking about physical life or health, that's one thing. If you're talking about mental health, it really means that it's up to the woman to decide. And the court may decide that they're going to allow partial birth abortions, except if it's necessary for maternal health in a physical sense, or they may just invalidate it. It's a controversial provision. In fact, it's the partial birth abortion is the only abortion procedure the AMA has ever said should never be allowed. Otherwise, they're in favor of doctors' rights for picking with the kind of abortion. And yet, you know, the National Organization for Women and the abortion rights groups are concerned that this would be the toe under, the nose under the camel's tent, or whatever the phrase is, the toe in the door. Mm-hmm. And so we'll have to see about that one. Another one that's I think is going to be fairly significant for people that work for unions, it was argued, yesterday, and that is we have the state of Washington has enacted legislation prohibiting the use of dues collected from non-union employees to cover political activities without their express consent. The Supreme Court decided years ago that you can force non-union employees to pay union dues that's necessary for collective bargaining. They get the benefit of collective bargaining. They ought to pay the cost, but they would have a right not to pay activities that aren't part of collective bargaining. Well, Washington State passed a law to implement that, and the state Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional, violated free speech. That's before the Supreme Court now, and that will be significant because it's a peculiar decision, but if the state can basically ban these, if these state laws are unconstitutional, organized labor will get more money for their non collective bargaining activities, basically political activities. And if it goes the other way, big labor will be losing some of that money. And in a sense, this is a campaign finance decision because the two biggest groups are big labor and big business that are contributing in various ways to political candidates. So that will be a big one. I think that the court will overturn the Washington State Supreme Court based on precedent, but if these cases were easy, they wouldn't have to get to the Supreme Court. I mean, I hate to make predictions as evidence of my fallibility, but that will be one that I make.
All right. Let's talk with another caller, someone in Belgium community, not far away. Line four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I have caught a great deal of your show, but I haven't caught all of it, and I hope I'm not asking a question that's redundant. Here recently in the news, we noticed Mr. Rehnquist has had a drug problem over the years. And at some points, it sounds like it may have actually interfered with his life, if not his judgments. But yet, Supreme Court justices are lifelong members and essentially under no way of being able to be removed from their position. Now, something seems quite wrong here. I mean, he could have easily been making decisions that have major influences on our lives and might not have been thinking right. Now, isn't there some kind of a problem here that we should fix?
It's a problem. I don't know how broad it is, but it's a problem. If you turn to the Woodward and Armstrong book, The Brethren, about the U.S. Supreme Court, they talked about the tail end of Justice Douglas's stellar career on the Supreme Court, where he was just a really very sick man who refused to resign. At one point, he did resign from the court, just stayed on and kept his office. That's always a tradition. And then he tried to file an opinion in one of the cases after he left the court. And he wrote it up, and he asked the law clerk to deliver it. The law clerk refused to do that. The court was in a little bit of a hubbub, and Douglas was too ill and sick to force it on anybody. But these things happen. We don't know if this affected his judgment, Rehnquist's judgment. There was one story that he was a little paranoiac, and on the other hand, it might have been valid. Who knows? But there is a problem. I don't know of a solution short of changing the Constitution. It gives them, you know, lifetime tenure and salary protection, so they could be impeached. Not doing their job. But we don't know if impeachment extends to that as opposed to more corrupt activities. And no court's ever they've never impeached a judge for that. They did once try in the early days of our history try to impeach a judge for it was the Republican Democratic Congress, and it was a very Federalist judge. The Federalists were a power party out of power. He was both a very partisan Federalist and an alcoholic. And ultimately, they decided not to remove him from office. That was the closest they ever came. But it is a problem. There have been proposals that there be term limits on judges. We could do that by the Constitution. You know, maybe 10 or 20 years is enough, and then move on to somebody else. There is this tendency to appoint them younger and younger and have them stay old and older. I mean, Stevens is, about 85 years old? And I don't know how big the problem is, but I don't have an easy solution.
Well, it seems that when the founders of our republic wrote this, people didn't live near the length that they do today.
Oh, absolutely right.
And you know, maybe there is time for some modifications, if not changes.
Yeah, there have been some proposals. It used to be, if you go back to the, let's say, 1916 earlier, the president would get about one appointment every 4 years. But Carter got none in his 4 years. Bush got none in his first 4 years. It's getting to be about one every 6 or 8 years. And when there are fewer appointments, there's more partisan furor over each one, because you're not picking somebody to serve 10 or 15 years. You may be picking somebody to serve 30 years. If Roberts lives as long and serves as long as, or if he lives as long as Stevens, he'll be on the court 35 years. And that may be good or bad, but in general, there's there have been proposals by some academics for some sort of term limits. There is some efforts to do this by statute. You know, there's a possibility. One possibility is to define a justice as a judge who's on the court for X number of years, and after that he goes to the Court of Appeals or someplace. I don't know if that would work, but that's one proposal out there, and then there's proposals for constitutional amendments. So it's a problem. It is we've relied on the self-restraint of the justices in the past, and there's a fair amount of academic support for some kinds of term limits for judges, but it's probably, I won't say it has to be done by constitutional amendment. There are some clever ideas to do without a constitutional amendment, and those might work. We'd have to test them. I just don't know.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Real quick, we're trying to get one more caller here. Line one, Urbana, hello.
Hi. I only caught part of your sentence about what Congress and the courts with regard to late-term abortions, and it made it sound as though you said the American Medical Association did not approve of this procedure.
Yeah, they wrote a in the last case that came up where the court invalidated it 5-4. They filed a brief that said they thought it was never medically necessary for the woman. That's probably one of the reasons it makes it controversial. If I don't know what the court will do about late-term abortions, if they do allow the states to prohibit them, I don't see that as a foot in the door to overrule abortion. I think it'd be written fairly narrowly. Or they might just say that that the particular law, what they did last time when they invalidated it, is that the particular law was unconstitutional. O'Connor wrote the fifth vote, and she said because it didn't have an exception for the life or health of the mother. That's where she raised the question about what you mean by health, because if you mean by mental health, then in effect there could be no restrictions on late-term abortion. That may be what she meant. She just wasn't clear.
I'm going to have to jump in here. I'm sorry. We just are going to have to stop because we've used the time. I'm sure we'll get back to some of these issues other days, but for the moment, we'll have to leave it at that with our thanks to Ron Rotunda. He's professor of law at George Mason University, where he teaches constitutional law and legal ethics. So, Professor Rotunda, thanks very much.
Thank you.